So Rabbi, so we are learning. I decided that between Pesach and Shavuos, there'd be opportunity to start learning on a new topic, a topic which I think is important, and that is we're going to take a dip into a sefer which many are familiar with somewhat, but not enough, and that is the Sefer HaKuzari, which is going to be the basis of a little bit of the learning we're doing in the next little bit. You can't learn the Sefer HaKuzari without learning a little bit of the background behind it. It was a remarkable background. And then we're going to start to get into some of the deeper ideas and concepts that he describes. Let us start to together. So, the author of the Kuzari is a person by the name of Rav Yehuda Halevi, who was one of the great Spanish Rishonim. He was born in the year 1075 Common Era, so 1,000 years ago, and lived to 1141. He lived in Spain, and Spain was a complicated time at that place at that time, because he was actually born in Toledo, Tudela. There's a debate, but generally understood to be he was born in Toledo. But Toledo was under Muslim control at the time. It's in the sort of center of Spain, but it was during this period in time that the Christians were moving their way down, and during his lifetime, at the age of 11, they already conquered Toledo. So his birth city was already now turned to Christendom. And this seemed to be the general move over the Iberian Peninsula. The top area, the north, was controlled by the Christians. The south was controlled by the Muslims. And the Jews did actually very well under the Muslims at the time. In this era, the Muslims allowed the Jews. It was a secular Muslim state, which allowed the Jews to thrive. And this was technically known as the Golden Age of Jewry. In Spain at this point in time, where there was an element of coexistence which existed between the three main religions in Spain. However, unfortunately, that was to end not too long after the Khazari's life, after Rav Yehuda Halevi, and that was because the Almohads took over from Africa, conquered the Iberian Peninsula in the south, and they were much more fundamentalist Islamists, and they were not very tolerant of the Jews. It's a pattern we see happening multiple times throughout history, in the name of the religion of peace. And Christendom itself became less and less tolerant, and there were multiple forced conversions of Jews throughout the 1200s, 1300s, and ultimately leading to Inquisition and expulsion when Christendom actually cleansed the peninsula. They finally conquered all the Moors, and at which point in 1492, upon conquering all of the Moors, that's when they kicked out all the Jews too. So just to understand the movements in the Iberian Peninsula. But for the period of life that Rav Yehuda Halevi lived, it was actually somewhat peaceful. He lived at this point in time when he was there was disarray, but he grew up to be a physician. He was a doctor. He was a respected doctor, but really his heart lay elsewhere. His heart was actually as a poet. He became very connected in Granada to a person by the name of Moshe ibn Ezra, and later corresponded with Abraham ibn Ezra, and became part of a poet society. And he wrote, today we have extant over 1,000 poems from Rav Yehuda Halevi. Remarkable. Very, very prolific writer. He wrote on all topics. He wrote on topics of life, meaning, fate, death, love. He had a lot of wonderful things to write about, some of which we are very much aware of today. As an example, one thing which most people are just not aware of is we sing his song every Shabbos, right? What's his song? Yonah Motzah B'Manoach is one of his poems, right? One of his Shabbos poems. He wrote extensively about Shabbos. Shabbos is one of the things he wrote about, like the Ibn Ezra, by the way. Wrote about Shabbos a lot. And we sing Yonah Motzah B'Manoach. And of course, you know, Yonah Motzah B'Manoach has five stanzas. And of course, the acrostic is Yehuda. That's how you remember what's going when, right? So Yehuda is Yehuda Halevi, as an example. Another thing that most people aren't aware of is, you know, when you go to any Judaica store, and you have a friend who's a doctor. Well, what's the gift you get a doctor in a Judaica store? You get the prayer for the doctor. That was originally written by Rav Yehuda Halevi as well. Generally speaking, the earliest form of that as well was Rav Yehuda Halevi. A lot of very, very beautiful things people are not aware of. He wrote, of course, Kinos as well. So he wrote many in many different kenos. He wrote the section of kenos called the Tzion kenos, the Zion kenos, the most famous of which is Tzion Haloi Tish'ali Lishlom Asirayich, where he addresses Zion, which is another name for the Yerushalayim. It's the adjacent mountain to Har HaMoriah. Today, just to understand the geography of this, most people are not aware of this, the Jewish quarter is built on Har Tzion. Right? So like, you know when you go to the Jewish quarter? So imagine you're at the Kotel and you want to get out to Shaar Yafo, right? What do you do? You go up all those stairs, right? And you come to the quarter, and then you go up again. When you're going up again, that's Har Tzion that you're going up onto. Har Tzion is the adjacent mountaintop to Har HaMoriah. And by the way, in the old days when Yerushalayim was built, there was nothing there. There wasn't anything there. Yerushalayim was built down the side of the mountain where Ir David is today. Har HaMoriah was the highest point of Yerushalayim. Right, today is they built the extended city, the new city, which we call today the old city, right? That's when they built outwards in this end of the Second Temple era to where Har Tzion is. But we call Tzion as a example of what Yerushalayim is meant to mean. So he wrote Tzion, he addressed Zion. Tzion haloi tish'ali, are you not going to call out or request lishlom asirayach for the peace of your captives? Remember that at this point in time, he is now witnessing in his early life the first crusade in the 1090s as the Christians are moving their way through Europe, decimating Jewish communities in their wake. And he's witnessing the conquest of Christianity in the north and the conquest of the Islam in the south. And most of them are not tolerant of Jews as he's experiencing this. And so he turns to Tzion, he turns to Zion, and that becomes one of the prolific themes in his writings, which we're going to see as well. And the Khuzari is very much the focus of the return to Zion, the return to Tzion. He says, and he calls them, Dorshei Shlomeich v'heim Yeser Adorayich, those who seek out your peace. Jerusalem, we're all thinking about you. Our eyes are towards the east, and we hope for you. That's what he describes. I mean, there's many poems that he wrote. Just he has a beautiful one translated. This is just the stanza, the refrain where he says, where, Lord, will I find you? Your place is high and obscured. And where won't I find you? Your glory fills the world. Like these ruminations, very beautiful descriptions of how he contemplates HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's really very, very special. And he wrote primarily in Arabic. Right? He wrote in Arabic. In fact, the book that we're about to read was written in Arabic first. And it's translated by the Ibn Tibbons in a number of different translations. No, sorry, Yehuda Ibn Shmuel, I apologize, translated from Arabic to Hebrew, which is what we have today, which is why you'll find a number of different translations, because it's not so easy to read Hebrew Arabic, right? And so like the same as goes for the Chovas HaLevavos and a number of works of the Rambam as well. They were written in Arabic, so when they are translated, the translation is complex because a lot of the translators do not translate phrase by phrase, but word by word, which means it's sometimes a little hard to understand exactly what was meant. Be it as it may, what he does was he writes in the last 10 years of his life, he writes his magnum opus. He writes, this is not a poem, this is his work on Jewish philosophy. And this is the book called Kitab al-Khuzar, which is the Sefer al-Khuzari. And it's interesting, actually, they don't usually include it on the cover of the books, but it did have a subtitle, which was, I'm just trying to see if I can find it over here, which is a defense for the most despised religion. That was how he described his the book. He understanding that Judaism is on the retreat, it's being attacked on all sides, and this is what he's writing about. So it is beautiful. Actually, I just put up on the first page, there's a few just different things. You know, there are a few in Israel. You can find Yehuda HaLevi wherever you go. You know, so in fact, if you search Yehuda HaLevi today, you're probably going to find more real estate dealers than you will anything about history, because it just happens to be everything in Israel's named after him. There's streets and there's areas, and you know. But nonetheless, in Caesarea, Caesarea, there's a beautiful statue among the statues there of Rav Yehuda HaLevi. And on the bottom right here, we actually have a number of his writings extant. Four of his letters we have actually his original writing. This particular letter, which was found in the Cairo Geniza, is actually a correspondence about a negotiation for freeing slaves. There was a young Jewish woman who was captured by Christian hosts as the Christians conquered northern Spain. And he's negotiating with a rich Jew to try to get the necessary funds to free her within time. And it seems that time is of the essence in this correspondence, right? So let's not think that he sat there on his philosopher's rock, you know, just waxing poetic. He was living the real life of complexity. Towards the end of his life, in his 60s, he decided that even though, you know, he lost his wife at a young age, he had a daughter. His daughter gave birth, we know of one son who was named Yehuda in good Sephardic tradition. And we don't know if she had other children, but he speaks of her, he speaks of his grandson. But at such a point in his 60s when, at that point in time, we can think of, you know, retiring perhaps to the French Riviera, instead he decides it's time to live what he's been writing about, and he decides to make his way to Israel. And so he boards a boat and arrives in Alexandria, which is a large Jewish community still at that time, is welcomed with great pomp and circumstance by the Jewish community. People vie to host him. For this period in time, we have correspondence from him from there. He stays there for about a year, and then he leaves to Israel. We don't have any documentation there afterwards, although there are different stories that describe how he arrives in Israel. And we never hear from him again. We hear that later on that year that he's died, in correspondence from others. But it's not clear where or how. We do know the suggestion that is given is that he arrives at the old city. He prostrates himself on the ground to kiss the ground of Israel, which he's dreamed from all this time, and is killed by these different interpretations, where it's an Islamic horse rider or a crusader. It's more likely a crusader because Jerusalem is under the control of crusaders at such a time, and he's killed there. And just by the way, the next time you go to the old city of Yerushalayim, you will find, where are Ma'alot, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi? Those are the stairs leading up from the kotel to that bookstore and the eateries and the square. That's called Ma'alot, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. The stairs are now, it's actually under construction right now, if you want to ask, you know, because they're always fixing something, so they've pivoted that route outwards, right? So it actually goes to the right, but on the left, when you go up, that would be the Ma'alot. That's always under construction, but that's where the Ma'alot Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is, and that's ostensibly where he died as he arrived in Israel. We're going to spend a little bit of time appreciating what he's doing over here. So let's start with his introduction, and then let's reflect of what's going on over here. So we're going to take a look at the bottom of page 2. Sha'ol sha'alu osi al ma sheyesh iti min ha'ta'anois v'atshuvois al ha'cholkim oleinu min ha'filosofim v'anshei ha'torois v'alaminim ha'cholkim al ha'mon Yisrael. I've been asked so many questions by people who disagree with Judaism on principle, whether they be philosophers, whether they be sectarian Jews, whether they be other religionists, co-religionists. So many people ask me questions. And he says, Zacharti ma sheshamativ kvar mita'anois e'chover Asher hayom etzel melech kuzar hanichnas bedas hayuhudim kayom hayom arka'arba me'os shana kasher nizkar v'noda v'sifrei divrei hayamim. He says, you know, that I remember there's a story, there's a legend that happened 400 years ago about a chaver, a wise Jew who corresponded or spoke to the king of the Khazars. Kinishne alav chalom pa'amim rabois ki ilu malach medaberi moi v'omer loi kavonos choratzuya etzel abore. And this king, the king of the Khazars, had this repeated dream in which an angel told him that your actions are not appropriate, but your intentions are appropriate. So he knew that he was on the right track to something, but he was not quite there. That's what he was told. And he spent a lot of time in the lore of the Khuzar, and he served in the temple of the Khazars himself, trying to find truth. And the more he tried, the angel kept returning and saying, your actions are inappropriate, your intent is correct. So we searched for truth with his nation. And so he says, I'm going to take advantage of that legend and I'm going to reenact the conversations that were had in those days. Now, just to understand what's happening. So by the time that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is living in the, now at this point in time, 1100s, so this is, we're talking about, he's already saying it's a few centuries past since this legend happened, right? So what is the legend? So it is important just to understand in terms of also just the placement, the locale, the geography of this whole business. And that is that there was a pagan country or nation called the Khazars. And this state was a part of the confederation of the Turkish or the Turkic-speaking states in the 6th century. And it was sort of in between, as around the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, between the two seas. It was between the Byzantine or the Roman Empire and the Arab Spring, right? The Arab conquest, which conquered the we'll call Middle or the Near East. And it sort of was wedged between those two kingdoms. This is from the Encyclopedia Britannica. Although the origin of the term Khazar and the early history of the Khazar people are obscured, it's fairly certain the Khazars were originally located in the northern Caucasus region and were part of the Western Turkic Empire in Turkestan. The Khazars were in contact with the Persians in the mid-6th century, and they aided the Byzantine emperor and in his campaign against the Persians. And what is fascinating about it is that we know that in the 8th century, so in the 700s, the Khazars, or a significant section of them, adopted Judaism. In fact, we have correspondence between Chastai Crescas and the Khazars already 200 years before, around this time. And so what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is doing in a very poetic and beautiful way is he's saying, I wonder what the conversations must have been like to arrive there. That's what he's saying. Meaning, how did the king of the Khazars, who was a truth-searching, Jethro-like, Yisro-like individual, who was trying to find truth, how did he find truth? How did he convince his nation of truth? What did that look like? And so what he does is he reenacts in a Socratic method. He sets up a conversation, which is, by the way, very engaging, because it's not now him writing to us a long essay for us to read. It's a discussion. It's literally a dialogue between different people, and he's now going to start that process again. So this is the basis of it. It's a very creative idea. It's not based on historical truth. I mean, he's not saying, I have the transcripts and my great-great-great uncle was there. He's not saying that. He's saying, I'm going to use this format as a way of describing this, and it could be anybody else. The Khazar could be, and what he's doing is he's going to use him as the questioner of Judaism, right? So he's going to use the Khazar, the Khuzari, literally, as the questioner, and it's going to be helpful because the questioner will ask some difficult questions which he may have been receiving from different quarters, meaning some of the quarters he may receive them were from confused Jews, from sectarian Jews. They were dealing with Jews who only believed in the written Torah at the time. We'll deal with some of them, the Karaites, later on as well. He's going to be with Christians, Islam, Muslims. So he's going to insert into the Khazar questions of faith from all sides. So that's the starting point. We're going to just do a little bit today and try to appreciate what he's trying to do, how the framework for this. Just before, we're not going to do all inside the initial paragraphs because they are long and extensive, but the way it works is that there's three conversations had at the very beginning. The first conversation is had with a philosopher, and he asks, so this king of the Khazars says to the philosopher, please tell me, what is truth? What am I supposed to be doing? I'm having this dream. And the philosopher says, and this is the general philosophy based on Greek philosophy. It's fascinating. The Arabs were very erudite at that time in the more tolerant secular Islamic societies. They were far more advanced than the Dark Ages in Europe in terms of science, philosophy, right? So, you know, meaning think of the greats of our nation that came out at that time. The Rambam, the Ramban, the Rav Yehuda Halevi, the Ibn Ezra, they were all products of all the great Jewish philosophers, not the Talmudists, right? Rashi, Tosfos, those are the Talmudists, but the great philosophers of Judaism came out from Arabic-speaking countries, and they were very well versed with Greek philosophy. The Arabs were very, very knowledgeable this time. A lot of the more advanced academic books were coming out in Arabic, not under the control of the church in Europe. So at this point, so he is very well versed, and he presents the philosopher, and the philosopher talks about the fact that there really was an olam kadmon. This is generally typical Greek Aristotelian philosophy, which is that the world always was. By the way, it's amazing. It's amazing to me. It's such a preposterous idea, right, that everything is always was because it is. It seems so preposterous, but that was the belief of the time, and you were considered completely and like an imbecile for suggesting otherwise. I mean, the Rambam has to spend a multiple 10-step proof to prove that their world at the beginning, like the Torah says, right? But Greek philosophy at the time assumed that there was the world always was. So the philosopher says the world always was. So he says, well, what's your relationship to God? This philosopher does believe there is a God, but in general. But he says, well, the main point of the whole operation is for you to purify your mind, to come to a closer sense of truth. And by coming to a closer sense of truth, you will automatically arrive at a refinement of character. That's what's going to happen if you spend time thinking more. And that's other. And you're no longer going to be a victim of circumstance. You're going to be an actor in your life. You're going to now change the way you live. And so the Khuzar says to the philosopher, well, that's all great, but I've been doing that. And I keep being told that my actions aren't working out. Meaning, it's like, so I mean, I'm there. I'm waiting. I'm looking. I'm trying. But it's not working, right? And so he pushes the philosopher further. He says, well, what religion? So the philosopher says, you can make up a religion, right? Meaning the philosopher says, it doesn't really matter. The point is just become complete, right? And so at this point in time, the Melech HaKhazar says, that doesn't add up, because clearly I'm trying that. I'm trying to get to this point, and you're telling me that it's arbitrary as to what God really wants. God isn't really interacting with us much anyway. So in a certain sense, then why am I being told that it matters what I'm doing or not? Because it doesn't really matter if it's not just about self-perfection. So he says, you know what? I'm going to invite to my court somebody else. So he invites in a representative of the Christian religion, and he starts asking him, and this person says, no, the world at the beginning, there was 6 days of creation, and there's a God who speaks to us and wants things of us. And so he says, well, how do you know? Like, how do you know about all this? He says, well, because it's written in the Bible. So how do you know? He says, well, because, you know, God spoke to the people. Which people? He says, well, initially it was the nation of Israel. And then he says, oh, he says, okay. So you don't have the proof, right? So he says, let me speak to the Muslim. So he speaks to a Muslim, and he says the same thing, and he asks him about him, his religion. He says, well, how do you know? He says, well, there were many miracles I've done. He says, well, did you see them? He says, I didn't see them. So he says, but how do you know? He says, well, the Bible tells us many things that happened, and there was all these miracles that happened. He says, yeah, but which Bible? He says, well, it's the Quran, because the rest was abrogated, but there was originally this Bible for the Jews. And so he says, you know what? It just keeps coming back. The philosopher doesn't really know what he's talking about, right? He seems to think that everything's arbitrary. We just make up our own subjective reality. The Christian and the Muslim seem to keep saying that we know all this is true because you go back to the Torah. So let me ask, you know, I didn't want to, you know, Nebuch the Jews, right? Because unfortunately you can see that they're in the gutter of history, right? In Europe they're falling, in Spain they're falling, they're not in control of Israel. They're this Nebuch group of folks. But nonetheless, okay, you know what can I do? I had to speak to them. Okay, Jew, come on, right? So that's sort of how he opens the book, and that's our conversation. So that's where we're going to pick up with. And so let's take a look at his first conversation with the Jew. The name of the Jew in this is called Chaver. Chaver, we translate today in common Hebrew as friend. It's not friend. It means a sage. It means a person who's well versed in ideas. So we're going to look at the first conversation, the first dialogue. We're going to break it up into dialogues. Our first dialogue is today, and he says the following: Amar HaKhuzari. Anytime you see the word Khuzari in the paragraph, it refers to the king of the Khazars. He says, Ani ro'eh shatzarach ani l'shol ha'yodim mipnei shehem sheris b'nei Yisrael. The Jews seem to be the remainder of the nation of Israel. Mipnei she'ani ro'eh shehem ha'tana ki yesh labore Torah ba'aretz. There seems to be a creation in the world. Achar kein kora chacham mei chachmei ha'yodim v'sha'al osoim el emun asoi. And he asks him about his faith. I would like to stop here for a moment as well. Just actually, Paul and Yael got me a book when I was sick, which I enjoyed very, very much. It was called A Prophet in the Andes, which is really a phenomenal, phenomenal book. And it's really actually a similar type of story, which is really, really phenomenal, about a young man in Peru who was you know, born into Catholic faith, and he started reading the Bible. He wasn't allowed. The Catholics are not allowed to read the Bible. It's just the Pope is allowed to teach, or the priest is allowed to teach. And then he started realizing that what was happening in church wasn't correct, you know, because they have lots of images in the Torah, says no images. So then he went to Protestant faith, and he went through, he cycled through Protestants, because he's like, well, but why are we doing Sunday? It says Saturday in the Bible, right? And then they said, no, well, then he moved to a different section, and they said, well, what about circumcision? It says circumcision of the flesh. It doesn't say the heart in the Bible, right? And then so they moved then he found a different section, subsection of the Protestants, and this movement towards realizing that the Torah is not talking to Christians, it's talking to Israelites, right? But I mean, if you just read the book, right? If you read the book, you're gonna arrive at the conclusion that you have to keep Saturday, and there are certain rules, and it's not Lent. It doesn't say that in the Bible, right? You know, and you just keep coming back towards truth. That's kind of this same journey of this fellow. Notice, by the way, the difference in terms between Yisrael and Yehudim, right? It grates my nerves all the time because I hear my children come back from school and they talk about the Yidden in Mitzrayim. There were no Yidden in Mitzrayim. I'm sorry. There just weren't. There were not a single Yid ever went to Mitzrayim. There were Hebrews in Mitzrayim in Egypt, and those Hebrews became known as Israel. And when Israel left, they were Israelites for the next 800 years. Next 800 years, they only started being called Jews at the times of Megillas Esther because they were the captives of Judea, which was the remaining kingdom, and they remained as Judeans and Israelim for the second temple. And then later on, you know, in the last few hundred years, where we adopted another language called, you know, a Germanic version called Yiddish, that's when, and we view that as our tradition. So it's important to realize, he says, the Jews of today, Yehudim of today, are a remnant of Sheris Yisrael, right? When we read the Torah, we talk about Yisrael. We're not talking about Jews or Yidden. So he's saying that's where we're coming from, right? So he's understanding the trajectory of this. When I'm reading the Bible, I see Yisrael. I see around today, Yehudim. I understand the two, they are the remainder. How do I know that? Because in Esther, it tells us that, right? The Yehudim. Right, so just understand the trajectory. Now, in paragraph 11, he says, Amar HaChaver, this is the first introduction to, now, imagine you are the Chaver right now. You've been called by the Khazar, and you have to present for the religion of Judaism. I'm not sure if you're necessarily interested in proselytizing, but you certainly are interested in representing, right? So what would you say? Like, imagine you had this moment now, and you had to represent, it's in your elevator pitch, right? You get into the elevator with the king of the Khazars, and he says, tell me about this Judaism thing. You sit down in the airplane seat, and somebody says to you, well, tell me about this Judaism thing. What do you say? It's hard. It's to try to formulate that in a coherent, cogent sentence or two. Not so simple. So it is interesting. Now, obviously, the Khazar is writing, the Rav Yehuda Halevi is writing the questions and the answers. So he's formulating the conversation, right? So he knows what he wants to get to. But just think about that for a moment, how you would do this. Here's how the Chaver does it. He says, Anachnu ma'aminim b'elokei Avraham Yitzhak v'Yaakov ha'motzias b'nei Yisrael mi'mitzrayim bo'osois uv'moisim uv'masois. He says, I believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who took the nation out of Egypt, the nation of Israel out of Egypt, with great wonders, v'machal kalom, b'amidbar, who sustained them in the desert, v'manchilom es eretz Canaan, and gave them the land of Canaan, achar asheri v'iram es hayam v'yarden b'mosim gedolim, and after he brought us through both the Sea of Reeds and across the Jordan River, v'shalach Moshe b'sarasoi, and he sent Moses with his Bible, his teachings, v'achakach b'chama alfei nevi'im acharov mazirim al torasoi, and thousands of other prophets who warned us to keep this Bible, this Torah, mi'adim agmul atov l'shomra, and they tell us that there's going to be payment good for keeping it, v'onesh kasher l'mamre oso, and bad punishments for those who transgress it. I believe in everything that's in the Torah, and there's a lot more to say. And by the way, you need to end your elevator pitch with that, you know. Irach Pirusha Zil Gomorat, there's more to talk about. Don't think that I've represented everything in the sentence. At which point in time, because the Khazar king, what would you say his reaction is going to be? And he's like, ah. He's like, ah. He's very disappointed in this presentation. Why is he disappointed? Why is he?
But that compelling.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. At this point in time, he's actually quite disappointed because look at his response. He says, "Maskima yisi shalaya shal Yehudi." Ah, I knew I shouldn't have spoken to the Jews. Right. So this has fallen flat right now. Why? It's an intellectually shallow experience, this Judaism. Ki ashiflus v'adalus lo yazvu lohem midat tova. The fact that they've been these desperate, impoverished, you know, sidelined, you know, subclass and other, now the society has left them intellectually impoverished. They clearly aren't thinking so well. Let me tell you, if I was answering on your behalf, I would tell you, after my study in comparative religion, I'll tell you what you should have said. He says, here's what you should have said. He says, You believe in the creator of the universe, like the Christian said, right? Umesadroy manigah, the one who leads it. Uvemisha barachov itchivchov adoy melas sipurim haele asher heim ta'anoes kol mi sheesh ladas uavarohu rodev ha'emes idamos laborebit zidkov v'chokmasoy. Talk about creation. Talk about running the world. Talk about the natural ecosystem. Talk about something which everyone can relate to, which is so grand. And you're talking about localized events, right? Meaning, like, first of all, in terms of, just think about what the limitation of the Jews' response. The Jews' limitation in response is not only is it in terms of scope, right, with the descriptions of what he said, limited, but also in audience, which is what we're going to have to get to as well. Meaning, the creation, the audience of creation is anybody, right? The whole world, it's universal. God creates, and look at the complexity of creation. That's very interesting. Very how big and how back to, far back do you go, right? Then maybe Rabbi Shmuel arguing. Exactly. So this is the question.
Where does the center of the Deborah start?
Very good.
The same question.
Exactly. And he's going to get to that. He's going to get that in a second. So this is the question. He says you're starting too small. You're starting too narrow in scope and in audience. It's too narrow. Why didn't you start earlier? By the way, the Christian did, right? He had different problems with the Christian, but why do you limit it to Yetzias Mitzrayim? So the Kuzari, the Chaver responds, his Amar Chaver, Zeshata Amer, Yadas Hakeshis, Aminagis, Mevia Lea Iyun, Venichnasim Bostve Kois Rabois. Vim Tishala Philosophim, Olea, Eina Motseo Samaskimim Amaase, Echod Voloyaldas Echos. So he says, you know what? You may be right that creation is universal. He says, but because it's so universal, therefore you don't have any clarity in it. So you're not going to have one philosopher, one scientist who's going to agree with another one about how this unfolded because it was so complex. How did the natural wonders, how did the world coalesce? You're going to have very different views. It took until the 1960s to prove the world at a beginning scientifically, right? To catch up with what the Torah says. So, like, it took a long time for folks to realize. Meaning, and what's the reason why this is true? The reason this is true is because there were no witnesses. That's the meaning. Although it is true that we could go out there and, you know, to measure something under a microscope or look out through a telescope, we're looking back through a lattice of creation. We weren't there. We weren't around. Right? If that's the case, that means that it's open to debate as to what really happened, which is why it wasn't experiential. Amara Kuzari, okay. Rani Dvarecha and Yudalet Hayudi, Tov mi Pisichasoi. That's a better start. Please carry on speaking. Now, by the way, whenever you have a Socratic method, you'll see the same thing with the Ramchal as well. You know, the main ideas are going to be questioned at the beginning, but then to keep up the dialogue, there's going to be these in-betweeners, which are sort of like natural conversations. You know, when you're listening to something, you go, uh-huh, yeah, you're right, or carry on and so on. So he's going to add those into our conversations throughout, these like sort of short lines about, I want to hear a little more, right? Because he's trying to keep up the conversation. This is not the main part of the conversation. This is just that the dialogue continues, so it's broken up as opposed to large essays. Okay? He says, Omar HaChaver, Afil Aval, Pesichas Tevorahi Amofes, He says, what I said at the beginning needs no proof. Meaning what I just said about Exodus and Israel, that needs no proof. He says, well, tell me, how do you know that there's no proof necessary for what you just said? Meaning, why is your version of reality so true? Amar HaChaver, the Chaver explains, Teni Rushus Lakdim El Akdamos, Kani Ro'eh Bohem, Devorai, Kveidim Olecha, V'naklim Be'enecha. A little bit of passive aggression over here. He says, I'm gonna dilute it a little bit. I'm gonna bring it to you too, so you're able to appreciate this. He says, by the way, whenever you wanna deal with somebody, you always appreciate somebody who's got something which is lofty, not somebody who's got something which is right. You want something which somebody's telling you this is something which is real. So he says, Teni Rishus. I'm going to give me a little bit of the Rishus to do this. And the Kuzari says, Hekdeim Hakdom Osecha Veshmayim. Please go ahead and tell them. So now, Amar HaChaver. The Chaver says, Ilu, he's going to give a metaphor for this. He says, Ilu Yamar Lucha, Ki Melech Hoidu Ish Chesed Ro'i L'Rabba Movel Oses Kavod Lishmo Vila Saper Ma'asov Bamesh Yagia Elecha Mitzedek Anshi Arzo Mito Samato Vois Vishe Maso Om Umatano Be'muna He Yisa Chayav Kobozeh. Imagine that one day he walks into your court Somebody says, you know, there's a king of India, Hoidu, right? Now remember, at this is for the next literally millennia, everybody in Europe is trying to get to India. Why? Spice trade, right? Because there is no refrigeration. The only thing which preserves any food is spices. The greatest spice export at this point in time is India. And all the folks, the reason they found America was because of India, right? And that's why they called the Native Americans Indians, because they were so confused, right? So the whole point was getting to India. That's the Dutch East India Company, and that's why Germany and Holland and everybody else colonized all the entire side of Africa, because they're getting round Africa to get to India. That's why the cross caravans across Europe, the crossroads of history were through Israel to get to India. They needed spices. So he says, so imagine that somebody comes to you and says, O king of the Khazars, you pay homage to the king of India, because the king of India is a wise and generous king, and he's got a nation which lives with upright principles and significant culture. Do you have a responsibility to respond to such a claim? As the king of the Khazars says, well, frankly, he says in parable, he says, I don't know, like, is there really a king there, like you're telling me? He says, oh, it's in Komach, Mas, Malkam. Are they really good because their king is the one who's in charge? Maybe they're just good and despite their king, right? Oy mishne paponim yachad. Is it governance? Is it people? Is it both? Like, I don't know anything. I don't even know if there's a king. I don't even know if there's a name, because while I'm here, it's all hearsay. Amar chaver, v'mayobawim alecha. But let's present another scenario. Let's imagine that you now had a delegation, shlucha b'tzurois adu'am hoidiois. You now had a delegation from India. And they bring you tributes which could only be from the kingdom of India. It could not be that they are coming from the next door in a bazaar in Khazar. And it's written a long epistle signed by the king of India. And they have all types of concoctions, some which heal you from ailments and some which protect you from future problems. And they also present poisons that you can use against your enemies. You can kill them by just a drop in their soup without even any war instruments. So would you be more willing to pay attention to what he requests of you? And he says, the Khazar, well, of course. Now this becomes geopolitics. This is international relations. This is State Department. Amar Khazari Kenu. So now I know there's a king, because I've received a letter signed by him. And I realize that there's consequence to what he has to say, because if he has these things, I want to be on his side, right? He's got what's called a QME, qualitative military edge, and I want to be involved with people like that, because otherwise my neighbors are going to have, I would like to also have these instruments. So he says, well, now describe the king of India, like based on your encounter with the delegation. He says, so I'll describe what I see. I see the grandiose of the people he sent. I'll see the honor of his God. So I heard of him first, but now I see it. I see the delegation. I see what he sent. I see what he represents. And that's where there comes the Nimshal. That's the way he's going to explain this over here. That is what I originally spoke to you about. What does Moses say? Moses, representing the God of the Hebrews, comes in front of Pharaoh, and he says, Elokei ha'ivrim shlachani elecha. The God of the Hebrews sent me to you. He says, Ritzoni lomar elokei Avram Yitzchak v'Yaakov, bibnei shehaya Avram ufursam etzel ha'umos. Everybody knew Abraham. Pharaoh knew Abraham. He was legendary, meaning I am the God of him. That's somebody you can know, somebody you interacted with. His great grandson was the one who reestablished the Egyptian economy, meaning that's a tangible experience that you're living with. And that's something you lived with. I'm not talking about the king of God, the God of the heavens and earth. He says, because that's debatable. You've got a whole pantheon of folks who you think created the heavens and earth instead of the one that I'm talking about, right? Because we're all philosophizing about that. That's why he introduced himself as watch. V'loi bora ivor acha. And he doesn't say, my creator and your creator. V'chein pasach elokim tovar v'lam on Yisrael. Similarly, the first last series of Dibros. Anachi Hashem elokecha. God says, that the first, this is the most consequential sentence ever uttered between the deity, between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and humankind as a whole. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I am Hashem, your God, Asher HaTzaisich, HaMeretz Mitzrayim, who took you out of Egypt. V'loi ani borei ha'olam u'borei achem. God did not say, I'm the creator of the universe. Why? Because these folks just experienced Exodus. You want to know who did what just happened to you? That's me. Not something that happened in the past. V'chein posachti l'cha melech ha'kuzar kasher shi'altani l'mo'asi. That's what I answered you. V'ashiv o'sicho ma'ashani chayav boi v'chayavim boi kol kal Yisrael asher yisborer etzlam ha'ma'amad ahu bir'ois eneihem v'achach ha'kabalah ha'nimsheches shi'kamarei e'ha'ayin. I'm talking about something which my ancestors experienced and they transmitted to me faithfully in the same way. Nobody says to me, you know, there was a different version. They know the whole that whole business at Sinai. It really was actually at a resort on the south coast of the peninsula. They liked the sea. They did scuba diving in the morning. They went for the mountain in the afternoon. Nobody has that version, right? Everybody has the same version that was transmitted to us of that experience which happened. Now, by the way, understand that what Rav Yehuda HaLevi is doing over here is a dramatic break from the what we're called the Jewish philosophy of date. If you look at the Rambam, if you look at the Rav Sadia Gaon, this is not the way that's described. Now, the Rambam actually is more complex, and it's not fair to paint the Rambam in such a way. But the Rambam, as an example, at the beginning of Hilchos Yisrael Torah says, Heach aderech la'avosav yiras. So how do you fear and love God? He says, "B'shash yisbonen ha'adam b'ma'asav u'bru'ov ha'nifla'im ha'gdolim v'yireh mehem chochmasoi she'en like erech v'lekeitz." How do you love and to fear God? Look into creation. And you'll see the remarkable expression of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? And that's what Avraham did, right? That's how Avraham Avinu got there. And that's how the patriarchs and the matriarchs arrived at truth. But he's saying post-Matan Torah, we relate to experience more than we relate to philosophy. Meaning if it's to philosophy, there's debate. Like how did it happen? How did it unpack itself? My faith is based on my parents, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, my great-great-grandparents. And the fact that we're all saying the same story. And here we're in the melting pot, whether it's in America or in Israel, and we have all these different traditions coming from every different country in the world, they all say the same thing, and we have nothing in common. No language, nothing else. But our religion tells us the same thing that our parents and great-grandparents experienced as well. So the Khuzari is talking about a Judaism which is experiential, a traditional Judaism, not a philosophical Judaism. Understand that if you're going to live in the philosophical Judaism of, as an example, Rav Sadia Gaon, that it's something which you will arrive at truth by logic and philosophy, then you're going to have a 2% of the nation of Israel that will arrive there who have the intellectual capacity to make that argument, and the rest of the folks, they're just not. And that perhaps is a very limited expression of Judaism in that respect, because then it's only relying on certain great wise people that it's accessible to. But this is the Judaism that he's describing over here is something which is very much experiential. And I would argue today, in our educational process, it's important to recreate experiential Judaism, because that's how we and our children and our grandchildren learn, which means finding experiences of Judaism and taking our children and grandchildren to them. Going to events which relate to Judaism being fun, enjoyable, overwhelming, beautiful, sad. Trying to pull ourselves into experiences, because it's not simply intellectually compelling. It's not only, it is as well, but it's not only intellectually compelling, it's experiential, it's tradition. Allow our children to go to, let's say, Yom HaShoah program. Allow them to hear what yester generation is saying, so they can be the links in that chain of experience. And these are very critical issues that the Khuzari is describing in this framework of religion. We'll end over here with the next question, the Khuzari, which is a very, very important question we're going to start with next week, which is, according to this, you're right that what you've gained by this argument is that it's now something which was tangible and experienced, right? And it's not debated. But in doing so, you've now limited the experience of God to one small section of humanity, right? Because in the end of the day, the Chinese did not go through the Red Sea, right? The tariffs were too high. right? the Chinese could not, they were not, the Ethiopians were not there, right? The Native Americans, right? They were doing something else at that point in time. So then if that's the case, then does that mean to say that God only spoke to the Jewish, to the nation of Israel? That's the question the Khazari asked, which is a very, meaning if I'm going to talk universal God, then universal God speaks to everybody. If I'm going to speak about particularistic God, and as experienced by Exodus, then I'm talking to a very small sliver of humanity. So what is the place for the other 99% of humanity, which is the next question the Khazari has about Hashem. We will pick up next week. God willing.